But it was she, and not the sea, we heard.
Hold it. That is any effort to understand, to achieve an understanding that is as big as the realm of being and fact, is always something we impose upon things. Now there's the fundamental sense. All interpretation is an imposition. All understanding is an investiture with which we invest the reality of the sea. Start very at the beginning and let's watch how the poet builds up this understanding that we are caught in a hermeneutical trap.
Very beginning?
Start it right from the beginning and read down till I stop you, Christian. Okay. You gotta get the music accumulating here.
She sang beyond the genius of the sea. The water never formed to mind or voice, like a body, holy body, fluttering its empty sleeves. And yet its mimic motion made constant cry, caused constantly a cry that was not ours, although we understood, in human, of the veritable ocean. The sea was not a mask, no more was she.
Oh, hold it. The sea was not a mask, no more was she. That is, neither that which I seek to understand is a vaporous non-reality. It's real. There's something there that I want to understand, and I who want to understand, I'm not a phony either. I'm not a mask, you see. It's the veritable ocean and the veritable mind that walks along the shore of the sea. Both are real, trying to understand. Okay.
The song and water were not medleyed sound, even if what she sang was what she heard, since what she sang was uttered word by word. It may be that in all her phrases stirred the grinding water and the gasping wind, but it was she and not the sea we heard. For she was the maker of the song she sang. The ever-hooded, tragic, gestured sea was merely a place by which she walked to sing.
Hold it. That is, this situation in which one is the maker of the song he or she sings. This is Stephen's point. It's also a town in Wisconsin. This is his point, that we are the makers of the songs we sing. The Gospel of Mark is the song Mark sings, and it is the song with which he invests the ineffable reality of Jesus. The hermeneutical job, the job of hermeneutics, of exegesis, theology, biblical theology, is always an active investiture. Now, this is the shocking thing which is at the heart of the intellectual fear of my life. It's not a fear before God, he can take care of it. But it's something that makes me look back at all the melancholy number of talks I've given and lectures I've made and little things I've written and think, I'll never do them again. I shouldn't do them again. I am the maker of the songs I sang. That's the way I understood it. Not only that, but that's true of the whole of Christian theology. Christian theology is never identical with the truth it talks about. God is never encapsulable within the capsules we provide for it. So when we talk of our Lutheran theology being true and faithful, well, it's as true as we can make it. And it's as faithful as fundamentally sinful people can make it. But there's something humorous about claims for theological adequacy. There's nothing, when we say the Lutheran confessions are a true, yes, true insofar as that time and that place could speak a faithful, believing word about the Catholic faith in a certain historical situation. But how vastly humorous is this notion we sometimes get, whereby we forget she was the maker of the song she sang. Luther was the maker of the song he sang. It's a very important song. It's one in which a vast number of persons of the human race find their own reality, their own understanding of the reality of God replicated, symbolically put forward, clearly stated. We honor him for that. But the same is true of Thomas Aquinas, John Calvin, and the Bishop's Statement on Peace, and all the rest of our theological efforts. Now let's hear how, not in my flat-footed language, but the way a poet puts it. Start back with those descriptions of the sound and images of the sea, the gasping wind, and so forth.
The song and water were not medleyed sound, even if what she sang was what she heard, since what she sang was uttered word by word. It may be that in all her phrases stirred the grinding water and the gasping wind, but it was she and not the sea we heard. For she was the maker of the song she sang. The ever-hooded, tragic-gestured sea was merely a place by which she walked to sing.
The implication is, the mind beholding the sea is simply one occasion for the same operation. She might walk beside a range of mountains or a picture of the complexity of human psychological life, like Lord Jim. That would be another occasion to sing a song of understanding. The sea was just a place by which she walked, but the same problem would emerge no matter where the mind walks. Okay.
Whose spirit is this, we said, because we knew it was the spirit that we sought, and knew that we should ask this often,
okay,
as she sang.
Now the poet seeks for a word to gather up the fullness of both the allure of the voiceless ocean and the unsilenceable nature of the human question for meaning, and to use the word spirit. What other word will handle it? Really, no other word is big enough to specify what we mean by the ultimate human energy that always probes for order and understanding, comprehension, to whatever degree, and the massive size of the phenomenon of human life. Only the word spirit, geist, esprit, only that is a big enough word to catch that. It's very interesting that a good deal of modern poetry, which returns to the necessity of that word again and again. I'm thinking of the poem some of you may know by John Berryman, the 11 Addresses to the Lord. Profoundly religious poems in which he is forced, despite his celebrated agnosticism, to use the word spirit to point to that which is both unmanageable, insoluble, and undismissible. Okay, let's back up a little and go beyond where you are, Grace.
For she was the maker of the song she sang. The ever-hooded, tragic, gestured sea was merely a place by which she walked to sing. Whose spirit is this, we said, because we knew it was the spirit that we sought and knew that we should ask this often as she sang. If it was only the dark voice of the sea that rose, or even colored by many waves, if it was only the outer voice of sky and cloud, of the sunken coral water walled, however clear, it would have been deep air, the heaving speech of air, a summer sound repeated in a summer without end, and sound alone. But it was more than that.
Hold it. Now look how wonderfully he says what it can mean. The moving of the water, even if troubled with many ripple, the coral, the sheer wall of water disclosing a coral reef, the mountainous distances, the horizons, the sound of the sea, the tragic, all this language about the sea. We are ten, in our time, it seems to me, the abyss created by the evaporation of religious faith is being filled for many in our generation by the celebration of these sounds and sights, the phenomenology of nature. What we used to call the transcendental, why is that dimension of human life being filled for your children and my children largely by artistic interests? Music, painting, sculpture, even their interest in the development of natural possibilities to their fullness on exotic foods, the interest in decor, the new thing in decoration, in clothes, in food, in lifestyle, oh blessed term. You know, what we're doing is taking the possibilities of the alluring aspects of nature and trying to fill the question, whose spirit is this? Trying to fill it up with these secondary effects and allurements as a kind of silencer for the unanswerable question, an unsilenceable question for which there is no longer a confessional answer. You see, that is the problem of our generation. My children experience the ineffability, the unanswerability, the allure, the mystery of life too. But when they cannot say with me, I believe in God, the Father Almighty, creator of heaven and earth, of all things visible and invisible. That to them is not a language that communicates. It doesn't literally communicate anymore to me, but I'm always dancing it up. You see, in my Christian mind and thought, creator of all things visible and invisible, that marvelous phrase, which we have incidentally in modern speech now dumbed down to all things, what do we say?
Seen and unseen.
What is it so bad I forget it?
Seen and unseen.
Seen and unseen. Isn't that one hell of a phrase? Why do we take this great phrase, visible and invisible, and reduce it to the banality of seen and unseen at the very time contemporary science indicates that the unseen things are exactly the real thing? That the secret of the small particles, the fundament of energy, the neutrons and the neutrinos, they're unseen. So just at the time when the old 5th century Chalcedonian language would serve us very well, all things visible and invisible, we stupefy it down to seen and unseen. I don't know what's I don't know what's happened to our minds as well as to our sensibilities. But a church which is capable of reducing up come Spiritus Santo, and also with you, is capable of anything. Well, okay. Now, the point remains the same. Most of us, I think, are able to take the old words of the creed. We have hermeneuticized them. We have evacuated them of the old way of affirming the reality and the presence of God in everything, all things visible and invisible. We've refilled those phrases with the richer, deeper knowledge of nature, of the doctrine of God, of the meaning of Christ. We've refilled them silently so that I don't have a bit of trouble on Sunday morning saying the old confession of the Nicene and the Apostles' Creed, though I'm always doing an action of draining and refilling. Always, I am the maker of the song I sing. Not that I do not honor the, by me, unsingable, absolute song of God, but I've got to make it my song over and over and over. All right, now, run back of three or four lines and advance beyond where I interrupted.
If it was only the dark voice of the sea that rose, or even colored by many waves, if it was only the outer voice of sky and cloud, of the sunken coral water-walled, however clear, it would have been deep air, the heaving speech of air, a summer sound repeated in a summer without end and sound alone. But it was more than that, more even than her voice and ours among the meaningless plungings of water and the winds, theatrical distances, bronze shadows heaped on high horizons, mountainous atmospheres of sky and sea. It was her voice that made the sky acutest at its vanishing. She measured to the hour its solitude. She was the single artificer of the world in which she sang. And when she sang, the sea, whatever self it had, became the self that was her song.
Hold it. The sea, whatever self it had, and that is not available to us. The interior selfhood of the sea. She was the artificer of the world she made. Whatever self it has, we give it. Homer gave the sea marvelous images of comfort, of hostility to man, occasional attack upon man. Think of the richness of the Ulysses, of the poems about the hero, and the sea is the world of torment, seduction, in which he had to find whatever safety he could find. Okay, well, I think I've said enough about that. Go ahead.
And when she sang, the sea, whatever self it had, became the self that was her song, for she was the maker. Then we, as we beheld her striding there alone, knew that there never was a world for her except the one she sang and singing made.
There never was a world for her except the one she sang and singing made. There is no world of Christian knowledge except the songs that are sung by those who were the children of those formative events, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, Paul. They were the makers of the song they sang. Now that doesn't mean absolutely irresponsible. They confronted deeds, events, episodes, facts, and they had to deal with them, and they did. But all of that fine fabric of theology, which is a theology of St. Paul, he is the maker of the song he sang. He understood Jesus in this and this and this way as against the Jewish background, and in terms of his own understanding and his own need. Let me be very concrete about this. In this group, I can make references you wouldn't make at an ordinary congregation. I mean, your knowledge is greater. Some of you know the wonderful article that Christer Stendahl wrote some years ago. It was first printed in the Harvard Theological Review, called St. Paul and the Introspective Conscience of the West. A marvelous article in which he says that St. Paul's own powerful introspective conscience caused him to write about sin and man's relationship to God through Christ as the forgiver of sins. Write about that the way he did. Now, he didn't what St. Paul said out of his own powerful, "Oh, wretched man that I am, who shall deliver me from this burden, this guilt, this death," he calls it. Christer says that's true of St. Paul. His own interior sense of guilt and wretchedness being trapped by the law caused him to develop a Christology of liberation from the law. Luther, as a 15th century medieval monk training in his own, had that same kind of interior introspective way of putting the problem and answered it, and found in St. Paul the perfect answer. Neither is wrong. Neither is untrue to the reports about Jesus in the Gospels. But neither is fully right either, because there are other ways. There are a sense of the interior seductions and power and wretchedness producing sin may not be the only movement within the self which creates longing, which creates an allure, an evocation for something not myself. And that's what we've got to do if we're going to do theology over and over again. You don't lay aside the Pauline, the Lutheran, the Calvinistic, the Book of Common Prayer, rhetorical solution of these problems. These are to be treasured, honored, but the modern mind never occurred before. I may be banal. That's why it is ours. Men have never put the question we're putting exactly as we put it. And therefore, your job and mine is to be aware of this, the ductility of language, the way in which the mind, the way of expressing the truth of the gospel as it fits the contours of contemporary anxiety. We must find a language ductile and malleable enough to honor both of them. And that will be a very suspicious operation in the view of the church. We might as well face that, the risky thing. Anyone standing within our rightly honored tradition and equally sensitized by the abrasions of contemporary life, who tries in a fresh way to bring these together, is going to be regarded as strange, kooky, far out, irrelevant, unorthodox, untrustworthy, a number of other nasty things. But this is the risk we take. And I would say it, not only that, it's the ministry to which we are ordained. We commonly don't regard the frontier aspects of ministry as being quite as honored or respectable. By the frontier aspects, I mean those of us who've got to work by ordination to be true of the then in the language of the now. I don't know who it was who said the language of the old cannot contain the experiences of the young. Now, that's not absolutely true. There would be no continuity of culture at all if they couldn't contain them at all. But the language of the old cannot contain, with all the the fluctuant nuances, the experiences of each new generation, but contain a good deal of it. Otherwise, why should Shakespeare continue to make sense? You know, King Lear, it makes a lot of sense. Hamlet and Macbeth and Romeo and Juliet make an enormous amount of sense. Well, let's push on now, because I think we're pushing the limits.
Ramon Fernandez, tell me if you know.
Now look, I looked up Ramon Fernandez. He was a minor philosopher, and I think Stevens uses him simply as a figure to voice a certain point of view. a companion of she who walks beside the sea.
Ramon Fernandez, tell me if you know why, when the singing ended and we turned toward the town, tell why the glassy lights, the lights in the fishing boats at anchor there, as the night descended, tilting in the air, mastered the night and portioned out the sea.
Hold it. That image here is so beautiful. It's not easy if you're a Midwesterner who's never been by a port on a lake or the ocean. The fishing boats are moored at night. There's always, by law, there has to be a little light at the top of the topmost part of the mast. And as the fishing boats bob in the sea, this light tilts from side to side. And as you watch the water in a dark night, the light tilts this way and illuminates with a little flash of light. This piece of sea moving here tilts the other side, illuminates that, and all spaces in between according to the inclination of the tilting light. The tilting light of our own vision is always gives us a certain perspectival image and limitation, both together. Now get the image again, the lights of the fishing boat.
Tell by the glassy lights, the lights in the fishing boats at anchor there, as the night descended, tilting in the air, mastered the night and portioned out the sea, fixing emblazoned zones and fiery poles, arranging, deepening, enchanting night.
All right. The light, as it tilts this way, illuminates a little section of the sea. And is not the life of each of us in this particular circumstance, to some degree, though enlarged by our reading and our culture and the magnification of our selfhood by literature and art and history, we are more than selves, but never fully identical with the whole human self. We look at the sea that's illuminated for us by the tilting light of what we're looking at. It measures, portions out the sea, entrancing, deepening. Okay, now he goes on with the question.
Oh, blessed rage for order, pale Ramon. The maker's rage to order words of the sea.
Hold it. That phrase, blessed rage for order, is a title that David Tracy gave his book, in which he elaborates the hermeneutical problem of contemporary life. He calls it the blessed rage for order. What does the phrase mean? Something very simple. Every area of human work exhibits a rage for order. Astrophysics is trying to find what is this pulsar or neutrino or small particle which is always seeming to elude us? What is the fundamental order of the atomic or subparticle world? In medicine, the fundamental research in all fields is to try to find as close as we can to the ultimate, what Einstein called a general field theory. A theory which he, in a special field theory of relativity, he made the first step, but he died not having articulated a general theory of relativity. And physiology, biochemistry, physics, all fields of research are impelled by a rage for order. Economics even. It led old Harry Truman to say, I wish God would give me a one-handed economist. One of them say, well, on the one hand this, and on the other hand. Every field, literary criticism, exegesis, theology, oh, blessed rage for order. Do we Lutherans not invest the whole of theological work with the fundamental, formal, principle, justification by grace through faith. Now that, to be sure, is a main member of the ship. It's certainly a powerful structural member in Christian theology. But when Eastern Orthodoxy says that the spirit that operates through the mystical love is the fundamental organizing principle, well, you could quote John as over against Luke to defend that. Or when the Anglican tradition has a marvelous ability to escape all propositional theological entrapments by an enchanting rhetorical tent. They do it another way. You read there's a woman at the University of Chicago who is studying the period in Episcopal Western theology in the Church of England. She's studying the period to produce the Collects, the English translation of the old Latin prayers, and some of them freshly created. And she's studying with astonishment how marvelously the Book of Common Prayer slips between theological Scyllas and Charybdis and go quietly sailing with beautiful language. They don't settle the question in the Book of Common Prayer between personal responsibility and absolute determinism of the will of God. They just say, Almighty God, who hath given us grace with one accord to make our common. So they seduce our mind with the beauty of holiness so that we dismiss the question. In some sense, that's not altogether. But it's very wise, too. The question is not dismissed, and they know it. But they recognize the allure that is more elevated than the carking presence of an unanswerable question and create a worshiping congregation of sheer beauty. Well, now let's finish this.
Oh, blessed rage for order, Pale Ramon. The maker's rage to order words of the sea, words of the fragrant portals dimly starred, and of ourselves and of our origins in ghostlier demarcations, keener sounds.
Those last lines are wonderfully so rich, I think. Blessed rage for order in words, which is our business. Those starry the portals. A phrase clear and still elusive. Of ourselves and of our origins. Who are we? Whence came we? Whither go we? What's God up to in all this mystery of cosmology, evolution, and all the rest? I chose this poem because it seemed to me in memorable images which might be useful for you in your teaching and preaching. It seems to me to sort of wrap up the problem, which has to do at the deepest level with fear, and yet offers a way to live with that constructively and even, I think, vividly and usefully. Thank you very much. I hope I haven't intruded on the time.
Confidence that our words have such a close relationship to ultimate reality, we'll at least do what we can do as human beings, sing our songs and try, beginning now with our creative production, do our part of the task that's been going on before us. So we have an hour and 15 minute block right now for this. We have some announcements. Okay. Remember, the next time we get back together now will be 1 o'clock, right back here. Lunch begins at 12, and time between now and then is yours. This room can be used, right? Okay. Dr. Sittler, will you be... Dr. Sittler, will you be available here for people?
Oh, sure. I'm here all day.
All day, yes.
For whatever use I might be.
Okay, now...
And then announcement. Someone said that he or she would like to hear the organ, and I called Phil Gehring, and he said yes, he would play for people that might come over a little after 11 o'clock this morning. He's going to be leaving Valpo on Wednesday, so that would be the only time we could do it. So if you'd like to hear the organ, he'll play for you a little bit. Well, let's say about 11:15 if you want to go to the chapel.
Okay, then. You're on your own.
And there's some